An Israeli ceasefire proposal is on the table.
You know, if both sides can spin it as a victory in a way that they achieve their goals, there does seem to be a growing public opinion on both sides that now is the time to move towards a ceasefire.
Plus, is this the end for American democracy as we know it?
I mean, democracies die and fade and authoritarians come to power. And we're not so special that it's not going to happen here.
And later, power outages across Ukraine and election results from India, Mexico, and South Africa. Today is Monday, June 3rd, and this is VOA's Flashpoint, Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. As Israeli forces are advancing deeper into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, U.S. President Joe Biden has declared that Hamas has lost its ability to carry out a major terrorist attack, and he's endorsed what he said was the latest Israeli offer of a ceasefire deal. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has the story.
Israeli soldiers moving farther into the southern Gaza city of Rafah after seizing control of the Philadelphia Corridor, a strategic territory along Gaza's border with Egypt. The Rafah offensive has killed civilians and drastically cut off the flow of humanitarian aid. 1 million people have left the city, most of whom had been displaced earlier in the war.
It's time for this war to end.
From the White House, President Joe Biden laid out a three-phase ceasefire plan that he says Israel has agreed to.
Israel has made their proposal. Hamas says it wants a ceasefire. This deal is an opportunity to prove whether they really mean it.
Phase one calls for a six-week temporary pause in fighting, during which Israeli forces would withdraw from heavily populated areas, free hundreds of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails, in exchange for Hamas releasing women, the elderly, and wounded hostages. Israel would allow Palestinian citizens return to their homes and more humanitarian aid. During phase two, Israeli forces would withdraw completely from Gaza in exchange for the release of all remaining hostages, including male Israeli soldiers. The ceasefire would hold even if talks dragged out past the initial 6 weeks. In the third and final phase, Gaza reconstruction would begin and the remains of all deceased hostages returned.
The people of Israel should know they can make this offer without any further risk to their own security because they've devastated Hamas forces over the past 8 months.
While Biden described Israel's plan as a comprehensive new proposal, other than a truce while talks are ongoing, the plan does not appear to be fundamentally different from past proposals that Israel has rejected, as it does not achieve its war objective to destroy Hamas. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he was not ready to surrender and fold or end the war before all its objectives were completed. Soon after Biden's speech, the Israeli Prime Minister's office released a statement saying its proposal allows Israel to continue the war until the destruction of Hamas' military and governing capabilities. While Biden envisioned the deal as potentially historic, details are unclear, including the level of Israeli military presence in each phase, as well as who will govern post-war Gaza. Gerald Furstein, director of the Middle East Institute's Arabian Peninsula Affairs Program, via Skype.
If there is a firm principle that Hamas itself will not be the governing authority in Gaza after Israeli withdrawal, if they're not going to provide security, then who is? What exactly is the nature of a follow-on Palestinian authority?
Meanwhile, Hamas considers positively the contents of Biden's speech, the group said in a statement. Patsy Wiedekuswara, VOA News, Washington.
As we've just heard, President Biden is pushing a ceasefire proposal to end hostilities in Gaza and bring the hostages back home to Israel. But is it enough? For a look at public opinion in Israel and in Gaza, I'm joined by VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Well, I think there are kind of mixed feelings. On one hand, people feel that, this ceasefire would somehow leave Hamas with you know, still having a role to play in Gaza, and that that's, you know, not what Israelis wanted. At the same time, there is a sense that time is running out for the hostages. The hostage families have been, you know, very vehement about that it's time to accept a proposal. And I think that Israelis have also kind of grown tired of the war. It's been now almost 8 months. And there's this sense that it's kind of stagnating, that Israel's not able to completely destroy Hamas. But at the same time, Israel has, you know, definitely scored a lot of strategic gains. So I think that there is a growing feeling in Israel that it's time for a ceasefire and that the government should accept this plan.
And what about for Hamas or for the Palestinians?
Well, you know, I mean, I talked to Palestinians in Gaza, and they also are just tired of the war. And I think one of the ideas of this plan is that, you know, both sides can spin it as a victory. You know, Hamas can say that they have managed to stay in power in Gaza. They've fought off the mighty Israeli army. But when you talk to regular people on the streets, they're tired of moving around. I talked to one mother who's moved four times since the war began and says that her children are suffering from trauma. There's not enough food to eat. Part of the ceasefire will be a big increase in humanitarian aid getting into Gaza, people being allowed to go back to their homes in northern Gaza, and a reconstruction of Gaza that it will take, you know, somewhere between 3 and 5 years. But I think there's also a feeling on the Palestinian side that they're tired of this war and they just want something else. And somehow, you know, if both sides can spin it as a victory in a way that they achieve their goals, there does seem to be a growing public opinion on both sides that now is the time to move towards a ceasefire.
And Linda, one of the things we've talked about before is Netanyahu's political position. He's sort of between a rock and a hard place. People in the United States, in the West generally, the families of the hostages want this to get wrapped up, to end. However, the right wing of his government, with whom he has his coalition, isn't really interested in a ceasefire as much. What's the right wing in Israeli politics saying about this?
So the two hardline parties led by Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich have said that they will bring down the government if he goes ahead and, you know, if he goes ahead with this ceasefire. And that's certainly something that could happen. And that would mean Israel moving towards new elections. And that's something that Netanyahu does not want either, even though it is something that the public wants. But at the same time, several centrist parties have said that they would support the government from outside so that even if the government fell, they would support going forward with this ceasefire. So Netanyahu could conceivably remain in power even if these two right-wing parties withdrew. You know, the question is, does Netanyahu really want to see an end to the war? What some analysts say is that it's in his interest for the war to keep going as well, because Israel won't have an election as long as there's a war. If there's a ceasefire, people will say, okay, now it's time for a new election. And the polls show that his Likud party and he personally would not remain in power. At the same time, I think if he does want to go ahead, and I find it very hard, you know, it's going to be hard for him to refuse President Biden, especially when this seems to be basically an Israeli plan to begin with that has perhaps undergone some changes. But so that's I think that, you know, he could move towards it if he wants to. And I think the public is pushing him to do that.
We'll leave it there for today. VOA's Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. Linda, thanks for your reporting.
Sure. Thank you, Steve.
And changing gears now, we go to the war in Ukraine. Emergency power outages were imposed on most of the country on Sunday, a day after Russia unleashed large-scale attacks on energy infrastructure and claimed it's made gains in the eastern Donetsk region. VOA's Lori London spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for the latest.
It was another tough weekend for Ukrainians, and over the weekend, Russian forces continue the shelling of the territory across Ukraine, mostly Odessa and Kharkiv regions. If we're talking about a Kharkiv region, which definitely remains the hottest spot for the past months, the past half a year, it looks like it's getting stabilized at the buffer zone, at the gray zone, but we can see that Russian forces had certain advance in that area, and at this point, the city of Vovchansk is the main city where the battles are taking place. According to Ukrainian authorities, 70% of the city is under Ukrainian control. Civilians who remain at the territory under Russian control are getting are basically hostage at this point. And Ukrainian forces predict, and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky announced that Russian forces for the next wave of the assault in the Kharkiv region, so situation might get worse sometime soon.
It sounds like they're really continuing to unleash large-scale attacks on energy infrastructure.
Yes, the latest shelling that happened over the weekend also damaged, once again, another shelling of the Dnipro hydroelectric power plant damaged the plant. And at this point, local authorities informed that situation is very serious. So it might be an accident if shelling continues. But at this point, the power plant do not produce any power, any energy to the Ukrainian energy system. This also caused the worsening of the situation on the Ukrainian energy market in general. So more blackouts are happening, more energy shutdowns are happening across the country, including Kyiv and Kyiv region.
And turning to the battle in general, it sounds like the Netherlands is actually changing a bit of their policy on how Ukraine is being allowed to use their weapons and fighter jets.
Yeah, particularly the fighter jets F-16, which Ukraine is expecting soon. There is a number of countries which will supply Ukraine with such jets. And the Netherlands is one of such countries. The authorities of Netherlands just announced that they will allow Ukrainians to use the F-16 jets, which they will supply to hit targets on the territory of Russia. Some of the countries did not comment yet if they will allow Ukraine to hit the targets in the territory of Russia, but some countries have already said that at this point they're not planning to do so.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. Thank you so much for the updates.
Thank you, Laurie.
Laurie London hosts Flashpoint Ukraine here on the Voice of America. She was speaking with our correspondent Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. We'll take a look at a growing crisis of confidence in the American judicial system in a few minutes. Now, though, some election results. A preliminary, though official, vote count released early Monday showed ruling party candidate Claudia Sheinbaum winning Mexico's presidential election and becoming the country's first female leader.
Hoy hemos hecho posible.
In a country with nearly 100 million Catholics, Sheinbaum would also be Mexico's first Jewish president. The vote count also showed Sheinbaum's Morena party winning large majorities in both chambers of Mexico's Congress. Meanwhile, on Sunday, President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa called for political parties to overcome their differences and find common ground to form the first national coalition government in its young democracy. His comments came in a speech straight after final election results were announced, confirming that no party had won a majority in last week's vote. Ramaphosa's African National Congress Party had already lost its 30-year majority after 99% of the votes were counted by Saturday and showed it could not surpass 50%.
What this election has made plain is that the people of South Africa expect their leaders to work together to meet their needs. They expect the parties for which they have voted to find common ground, to overcome their differences, to act and work together for the good of everyone.
The ANC was the party of Nelson Mandela and freed South Africa from the apartheid system of white minority rule in 1994. It had governed with a comfortable majority since then, but this election saw an unprecedented slump in its support. Without a majority, it will need to agree on a coalition with another party or parties for the first time to co-govern and re-elect Ramaphosa for a second term. And early election results are in from India as well, where it looks as if Prime Minister Narendra Modi will win a third term. The news has had an immediate effect on India's business community. Reuters' Gabe Singer has more.
Indian shares soared to new heights on Monday as exit polls pointed to a landslide victory and third term for Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Opening trade on Monday also saw gains for the rupee and drops in bond yields as investors eye public spending to maintain economic momentum. The Nifty stock index rose nearly 3.6% in early trade to hit a lifetime peak. Weekend exit polls projected the alliance led by Modi's BJP party is likely to secure a two-thirds majority in the lower house, which is enough to initiate amendments to the constitution. A win had been widely expected, but that result, if confirmed, would be larger than analysts' forecasts. That will be seen as a positive for equity markets that have scaled record highs on the back of economic growth. Data showed last week that India's economy expanded 8.2% over the financial year to March 2024, led by government spending on infrastructure and a boom in real estate. Analysts say a sweeping mandate by Modi could give him the political capital to keep going and perhaps even push for tougher land or labor reform. India's exit polls have a patchy record, however, often getting the outcome wrong. The results of the general election among a billion eligible voters are due to be officially announced Tuesday.
That's Gabe Singer reporting for us today. And finally, a crisis of confidence. Donald Trump and his allies say the judge presiding over the case that convicted him last week was biased against him. Others point to Supreme Court Justices Thomas and Alito's recent controversies over perceived bias and improper behavior as examples of right-wing bias on the highest court in the land. If public trust in the judiciary continues to drop, what are the consequences for America? My guest is Sarah Benesch. She's chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee.
So the Supreme Court tends to make its own rules in large part for a lot of aspects of its work. And recusal standards and ethical rules are one of those things. So for a long time, the Supreme Court didn't have its own ethics code. There was a code that covered lower court judges in the federal system, but no code that covered the Supreme Court. Of course, there is a statute that covers the Supreme Court, and so they are at some level beholden to that statute. But even the statute and the ethics rules that apply to the lower courts really leave the question of recusal up to the individual judge. And there's lots of reasons why judges would err toward staying on a case, and we want them to do that, because when a justice leaves the Supreme Court's decision in a particular case, for example, then we're down to eight. And eight is an even number, and so there's a greater likelihood of a tie, in which case nothing will happen besides just sort of the affirmance of the lower court. And so there are institutional reasons why we want the justices to participate in cases, but, you know, there are a lot of questions that are being raised about impartiality today that we know has ramifications for the ways in which people perceive the courts. And given the courts don't have a lot of power on their own, you know, there's no sword, no purse, as the Federalist said, they really have to rely on legitimacy as their power so that people will comply with their rulings. And to the extent that their engagement in cases where there is a question over impartiality hurts that legitimacy, we expect that their power will be lessened as well. And at some point, you know, we have placed the rule of law in danger.
So the question of legitimacy might outweigh these institutional reasons for staying on the bench.
Right, right. And I think, you know, that's a difficult question to try to study. So political scientists generally have looked at public opinion about the courts and have really framed the drivers of legitimacy to be this feeling that courts are sort of above politics and that judges make decisions in principled ways that are not driven especially by partisan interests, but also by their own ideological policy predispositions. And so to the extent that the justices behave in ways that question that differentness or make them seem like any other politician, can raise some issues with what we understand the public to sort of expect from judges.
So in the aftermath of the 2020 election, the legitimacy of the elections themselves were called into question. Many now are calling into question, or at least viewing skeptically, the Supreme Court. These are two of the biggest pillars of American democracy. If those are questioned, if their legitimacy, their very existence is questioned, what does that mean for the country going forward? How can the United States get back on a more solid ideological footing?
I think that's a fantastic question. And I think everyone in the United States should be asking themselves that. Because I you're exactly right. You know, so without elections, and elections legitimize government, right? When people feel like they have an opportunity to weigh in on who governs them and that they can do so fairly, and you know, and we have a peaceful transfer of power and all of those kinds of things foundational to democracy, as is the rule of law, and you know, a Supreme Court that's charged with upholding the Constitution. Once those actors, you know, be they, you know, the losing candidate for president or members of the United States Supreme Court, start behaving in ways where those assumptions, those sort of bedrock principles, are no longer operative, we do have trouble. And, you know, I mean, the United States thinks itself to be very special in the world. And sure, there's a lot of things that we've done that no one else has been able to do. But we're not so special that we can't lose this thing. And, you know, I think Franklin called it a big experiment at some point in his writings. And I think that's, you know, definitely true. I mean, democracies die and fade and authoritarians come to power, and we're not so special that it's not going to happen here.
There's a certain amount of irony, you might say, in watching Donald Trump after his guilty verdict, and even before, talking about a crooked, corrupt judge, while many of the people who oppose Donald Trump are looking at the Supreme Court and also seeing what they're calling essentially crooked, corrupt judges, having taken money in vacations or flying these symbols of rebellion against the United States. Are there parallels there, or is that a good example of why impartiality must be sacrosanct in the judiciary?
I think it's an example of what, you know, political psychologists have for a long time recognized as the way people think about things. And that's through motivated reasoning, right? So we see opinions that we dislike and we charge the decision makers with bias. And I think that is, you know, exactly what you see in Donald Trump's case. So while his particular judge is obviously biased, and he's called other judges, so-called judges in the past as well, that disagree with him or think differently from him, you know, Samuel Alito is not biased in his view, right? And the reason is that one decision maker is giving him what he wants and the other one isn't. And we know that that's not, you know, that's not just Donald Trump that thinks that way. That's the American public. That's a general human proclivity, right? We see things through our ideological predispositions. And today in the United States, given how polarized politics are, it's really hard to agree on anything anymore. And I do think that that's dangerous, because if we can't agree on the rules, if we can't agree on truth, if we can't agree on the facts, how do we keep this thing afloat?
Sarah Benesch is a professor at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. Dr. Benesch, thanks for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.